Soon I had resumed my double martini and two beers at lunch, with lots of coffee afterward to sober me up for the deadline sprint at the end of the afternoon. Nights were reserved for oblivion drinking. My newspaper sent me to Paris in January 1973, a wonderful advance in my career. Professionally, it was exciting. Personally, I was achingly lonely, so far from friends and home. Soon, however, I fell in with a terrific bunch of drinking buddies. I was writing and reporting well, I thought, but it was becoming harder. I was struggling at the typewriter, taking hours to do stories that I used to finish in 45 minutes. I often lunched alone at a little restaurant near the office called Le Sportsman, so that I could read all the Paris newspapers and drink in peace. One day, deep in my newspapers, gently glowing after my usual two double scotches and a carafe of wine, I heard the varnished blonde who ran the place talking in French to another customer. "She gets drunk here very nicely every day," the woman said, "and then very nicely she goes away." I never went to Le Sportsman again. I got drunk elsewhere. Being a drunk in a good job in a beautiful city was as sordid and as shaming as it would have been in squalid surroundings. I began taking a whiskey or two in the morning, rationalizing that it would get me through the day's tensions. I bought bottles at different shops in my neighborhood so nobody would know my true intake. I felt utterly alone with my guilty secret. The rash on my palms reappeared. I remembered Dr. Thompson's warning. Finally, late in 1974, loathing my obsession and terrified that it might cost me my job, I went to my doctor at the American Hospital of Paris. "I think I'm becoming an alcoholic," I told him. He offered to put me in the hospital for a week to dry out, and added, "I'd like to send some people up from AA to see you." I gratefully agreed, because I had heard over the years that those AA people could perform miracles. The next morning, a friendly, attractive young American couple entered my hospital room. They were from Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not remember a word they said except that there was a meeting twice a week at 8 p.m. at the American Church of Paris on the Quai d'Orsay. I attended several AA meetings, sitting with a dozen others around a table to tell my story, but I was not ready. Soon I began to make excuses, the most powerful being that 8 p.m. was my deadline hour for filing stories to New York. I would not admit to myself that I could have written most of my pieces by early evening. The months that followed were full of remorse and confusion. I did not go again to AA. "I have the willpower to stop myself," I thought. I swore off drinking repeatedly. I could not keep my resolve for more than a week. I was so depressed I was almost incapable of action. The morning drinking got worse. I needed booze to still my trembling hands and give me the impetus to get out of bed and go to the office. My doctor at the American Hospital recommended a French psychiatrist who had impressed him. I went to the psychiatrist and ran through my drinking and depression story. After 50 minutes, he ended the session by saying, "If you continue, you will destroy yourself." I went straight to the nearest cafe and gulped down two double scotches. Fuck him, the self-righteous bastard. In April 1975, my newspaper sent me to Lisbon to cover the first free election in Portugal in 40 years. I hired an interpreter and went about the city and the surrounding countryside for 2 days, interviewing everybody in sight and taking notes. At night, I drank heavily with my foreign correspondent friends in the bar at the Hotel Tivoli. On the third morning, having cabled the New York office to expect a long descriptive article that day, I sat down at my typewriter. I read and reread my notebooks, underlining important passages. I read the lines over and over. They were chaos. Or rather, my mind was chaos. I could not write a single sentence. For the first time, I could not summon at will almost 30 years of discipline and experience as a professional reporter. I paced that hotel room, drenched in sweat, for 8 hours. I sat and shook and stared at the typewriter. The words in my notebooks bounced out and jumbled together. I thought of throwing myself in the River Tagus. I had never, never not met a deadline. Late that afternoon, I called my bureau chief in Paris. "Flora," I said, "I'm at the end of the line. I can't read my notes. I can't write a word." "Don't worry, dear," she said. "I'll call New York and explain. Get the next plane back to Paris and come straight from the airport to my apartment." Back in Flora's apartment, I faced a friend who was all sympathy. "It was nervous tension," she said. "It was exhaustion. I'd been working myself to the ragged edge." It isn't any of that, Flora, I said. It's booze. She didn't believe me. I want you to talk to Dr. Fred Plum tomorrow, she said. Flora explained that he was a family friend, a brilliant diagnostician, the chief neurologist at New York Hospital, who, as it happened, had just arrived in Paris for a medical convention. He'll know what's wrong with you, Flora said. I met Fred Plum in the Tuileries Gardens the next morning. He was a dapper man with a resonant voice and a self-confident, cordial air. He loved Flora and her children. He put me at ease. We sat on spidery little chairs in front of the Jeux de Paume Museum. I talked for almost an hour about Stan, my grief, the onset of menopause that had coincided with his illness and death, my drinking, the crisis in Lisbon. I told him I enjoyed nothing any longer, that I slept constantly when not working or drinking, and that the world looked unrelievedly grim to me. I had been by nature a sunny, optimistic creature. Now I loathed even getting up in the morning. I felt numb, anesthetized. Very quietly, Dr. Plum said, "You are clinically depressed." He told me that the chemical effects of menopause could be profound and could go on for years after onset. And your drinking reinforces your grief and your loneliness and your depression. He confided that he was the son of a wonderful man who had died an active alcoholic, irreparably damaging the family. He was convinced I could not get well in Paris. I know your French is fluent, but you must be treated by a psychiatrist whose culture and frames of reference are your own, he said. You've got to be in a place where you already have friends and family. Then he said you must do three things. You must go home to New York, you must stop drinking, you must enter psychotherapy. For the first time, I believed all of it. Yet it brought me no relief. In agony, I thought, this is the end of me and of my career as a foreign correspondent. I felt I had betrayed Flora, my boss. She was the first woman bureau chief in my newspaper's long history. I was her number two. There had been battles among the male executives at the highest levels of the paper over whether a woman could run a bureau and later whether another woman correspondent should join her. We'd showed them that two women reporters could perform very well together and had become close friends in the process. Now I would be going home, I believed, in disgrace. That conversation with Dr. Plum was the beginning of the way back. I was convinced he was right, but I could not bring myself to do what he was asking. Without Stan, my work had become my life. Yet I could not stop drinking. I drank to smother my remorse and my indecision, my sense of failure. I was wallowing in what the French called la nostalgie de la boue, a yearning for self-degradation. Flora came back to Paris after a long working trip out of the country and found I had been neglecting assignments, cowering at home in bed. You are very, very sick, she told me, her patience finally exhausted. You are far sicker than I thought you were. I know now that I was desperate for her to believe that. I was ill with lying, sick to death with covering up. She could no longer ignore my erratic behavior. I learned much later that the way I was recklessly squandering my Paris assignment, almost inviting disaster, was really a final cry for help. I went home to New York in August 1975. Dr. Plum was waiting with his daughter Carol at the airport. He persuaded a psychiatrist friend to take me as a patient. I rented a room in an acquaintance's apartment while looking for a place of my own. I stayed miserably sober for weeks at a time, and then went on secret 2 or 3 day benders, smuggling bottles into my room and locking the door behind me. My editors, notably the executive editor Abe Rosenthal, were sensitive and understanding. They saw me teetering on the verge of a nervous breakdown. They could sense I was close to cracking up, but they did not know the drinking part of it. Early in November 1975, Dr. Howard R. Brown, the director of my newspaper's medical clinic for employees, told me as authoritatively and as kindly as Dr. Plum that I was an alcoholic. By this time, I was almost certain that I was, but my shame was such that I denied it. Dr. Brown suggested that he put me into Smithers Intensive Rehabilitation Center in Manhattan. It had achieved a remarkable record of success with alcoholics. He gave me a brochure showing some shots of the center in a beautiful mansion just off Park Avenue on 93rd Street. The treatment inside the residence would last 1 month. My despair lightened. It looked like a lovely place. I said I would go. The next Monday, the morning of November 10th, 1975, I sat on the edge of my unmade bed, surrounded by packing cases from Paris in a bare apartment I had rented days before. I was due to enter Smithers at 3 o'clock that afternoon. I toasted myself from a soggy paper cup brimming with scotch, luxuriating in self-pity. I was on my way to a fancy drunk tank. So, Nan, I said to myself, you have come to this. I must say I took my last drink in style. I went to Sardi's with my editor, Joan Whitman, and one of my closest friends, Ruth Adler. Lying to the end, I told them that Dr. Brown had recommended that I have a couple of vodka martinis before going to Smithers to boost my resolve. Then I rolled off uptown in a taxi and landed half-bombed in Smithers' elegant lobby on 93rd Street. "Are you an alcoholic?" asked the kind nurse who admitted me. "Probably," I said airily. "Have you ever had memory blackouts?" she went on, smiling encouragingly. "Have you ever sneaked drinks?" There was nothing judging about her. "Do you find it difficult to discuss your drinking? Do you take a drink in the morning to stop tremors? Do you think about drinking a lot? Do you sometimes neglect to have a meal?" I answered yes to all her questions. The truth dawned that I was really an alcoholic. I did not feel shattered. I grinned at the nurse. "Yep," I said, "I sure am an alcoholic." There, I'd said it. I was overwhelmed with relief. I sat down to supper at Smithers soon thereafter, swinging up to the sky on a trapeze of wild exhilaration. I was genuinely intoxicated, not just from Sardi's martinis, but from the knowledge that at last I was not alone. I went through the cafeteria line and sat down at a round table in the stately dining room with three women and a skinny young man named Tom. I barely noticed what they looked like. I was too busy congratulating myself on my decision to come to that place. Here were alcoholics just like me, forking in the meat and potatoes, all of us being saved together. I loved those strangers. I knew I would love the staff of doctors, nurses, psychologists, and social workers, most of whom were recovered alcoholics. They'd been there. They knew what it was all about. I was insufferably happy. Tom told me he was a doctor. I was astonished, but his news made me feel more ebullient. I thought even doctors can be alcoholics. Days later, when we had become friends, Tom said to me, "The night you came in here, you were babbling like a maniac. You couldn't stop smiling. You made a little castle of your mashed potatoes with a gravy moat all around it, and you hardly ate a thing. You must have been bombed out of your mind." I was assigned a bedroom with a huge carved fireplace and French doors opening out onto a balcony overlooking a back garden. My roommates were two welfare mothers, an 18-year-old ballet dancer burned out on drugs and booze, and a chirpy middle-aged society matron. I lay awake all that night in a state of sober euphoria. I thought, I've been given a gift, the gift of writing. I have abused that gift. I also thought, I've been given a chance to change my life. We were up at 7 to make our beds and go down the curving grand staircase to breakfast. The rest of the day was tightly structured, packed with lectures, films, and meetings with our counselors. I was asked to fill out a Blue Cross hospitalization form for my employers to cover the expensive month's stay at Smithers. I came to the line that said reason for hospitalization. I could not bring myself to write alcoholism. Now everybody at the office will know, I thought. I left the line blank. Ashamed, I told myself, let somebody else fill it in. I was quickly back in a manic mood. I phoned all my close friends and told them where I was and why. I was making what I thought was a major disclosure. I'm an alcoholic, I cried joyously. It came as no surprise to any of them, but without exception, they responded with hope, pleasure, and support. I considered myself a model Smithers patient. I met every challenge seriously. I did not shirk my homework. I threw myself into my first encounters with group therapy. I made friends with almost all the other patients. In a foretaste of my future experience with fellow alcoholics in AA, the patients proved to be my most effective therapy and support. The day before I was released, I asked to see my medical record, which contained the staff's prognosis on my chances of making it. I read their conclusions in private. They thought I would drink again. One counselor wrote that it was likely that I was treating the Smithers experience as just another assignment, and that I would leave it behind me as I had so many repertorial adventures to go on to fresh excitement. I was gripped with rage. I raved to myself that what I had regarded as the most courageous act of my life had been greeted with disbelief and contempt. When I was able to control myself, I thought, I'll show them, the ungrateful sons of bitches. I won't drink again. I will never know whether the staff gambled that because I was a reporter, I would be one of the rare patients to know that I had the right to see my confidential medical record. They may also have gambled that my enormous resentment at their prognosis would pay off the right way, fueled by my obvious will to win. Smithers had taught me that resentment was one of the alcoholic's worst enemies. Without their teaching, I could just as well have said, I'll show them, I will drink again. I am convinced now that the final kick in the teeth that Smithers gave me was the healthiest graduation present I could have gotten. On the morning of December 8, 1975, I said goodbye to Smithers. As usual, there were hugs and kisses from the other patients, the counselors, and the nurses. I know you'll make it, Nan, said Donna, a patient. I thought, it's a good thing she hasn't read the staff report on me. I pushed open the heavy glass and iron front door and went out into the noisy streets of Manhattan. I passed Notaldini's, a restaurant bar around the corner where so many patients who had bolted Smithers had gone to tie one on. I hailed a taxi to take me home. I was nervous and disoriented, but hopeful. That night, armed with a meeting book that lists the days, times, and places of hundreds of AA meetings each week in Manhattan, I went to the group that met each Monday in the parish house of an imposing Gothic church on Upper Fifth Avenue. Despite Smithers, I was not prepared for what I saw. I somehow expected a gathering of shabby depressives, yet there before me was a quintessentially Upper East Side Episcopalian congregation, some men in pinstripes, many women shod in low-heeled, perfect Ferragamo pumps, with bits of discreet family jewelry at the throat and the wrists. The hospitality committee of my fellow drunks welcomed me at the door with smiles and handshakes. Their warmth swept away my timidity. The meeting was as impeccably ordered as any Sunday service at my own church, St. James, a mile down Madison Avenue. During the weeks that followed, I went table-hopping every night to a different meeting, each featuring a slice of New York life. There were blocked writers expressing their angst on the Upper West Side and blue-collar workers in Brooklyn recalling bars they had loved. The beginners' meetings everywhere were charged with raw emotion close to the edge. The people in them, only days or weeks away from their last drink, could be on pink clouds of jubilation or jittery, unstrung, and sullen. In distinct contrast to the group I had gone to my first night out of Smithers, the dress code was universally casual. Soon I began to see why AA members kept going to meetings. They comforted and centered me. The people in them steadied and supported me in ways as small but crucial as an arm around my shoulder. Sometimes my attention wandered for stretches of time while I retreated into my own thoughts. Sometimes I was bored, but a speaker or even a sentence uttered from the floor would get through to me. At one meeting, a man said, I began coming to these basements, and I discovered that I was right about myself. I am a decent person. I thought with surprise, so am I. I helped make coffee, unfolded chairs, cleaned ashtrays when the meetings were over. Veterans asked me to come with them to nearby coffee shops afterwards, and in these little clusters I enjoyed their stories, told my own, made friends, swapped telephone numbers. But I was afraid to speak up in meetings. Finally, after 4 months in AA, I raised my hand in a group that gathered near my apartment. Overwhelmed with nervousness, I said, My name is Nan, and I am an alcoholic. I've been sober 4 months, and I'm so grateful to be here. I could not go on. My voice trembled, and I knew that if I said anything more, I would burst into tears. Everybody in the little group turned to me, smiling and applauding. They knew that the beginners are the bravest ones, enduring the hardest times. They knew that as you go on, it gets easier. Those first months, I simply put one foot ahead of another. I took everything the old-timers told me on faith. They told me not to take that first drink and to go to meetings every night. I was often depressed. I disliked much of the AA official literature and its onward and upward with Babbitt tone. I was convinced I could never again enjoy life with my old gusto. My work did not interest me. I believed I would never again experience life with the intensity that had been natural to me in my best years. In the winter of 1976, just 2 months out of Smithers, I experienced my first strong compulsion to have a drink. I had thrown out all the liquor in my apartment, and so when three friends asked me to go to a theater matinee with them, I suggested that I fix them lunch at home and that they bring their own wine to accompany it. They arrived with two bottles of white wine, but drank only one. I put the other in my refrigerator, and we went off to the theater. My mood darkened during the play. I could not concentrate. I went home and opened the refrigerator door. There was the bottle of wine, dewy and inviting. My mouth watered. I reached for it. Then I slammed the refrigerator door and rushed to telephone an AA friend. She told me, get that bottle of wine and pour it right now down the sink. Now, I'll hang on. I did as she asked. We talked for 30 minutes, and by then my obsession with the wine had dissipated. In the early spring of 1976, I began to be swept along in a manic rush like that on my first night in Smithers. One day I woke at dawn in what I can only describe as a state of exaltation. I was weeping with wonder and gratitude alone in my bed. I felt a terrific need to telephone the psychiatrist who had been treating me for depression or to rush into my church and pray. It was much too early to do either. And then I thought, my soul is my church. I read the 23rd Psalm over and over. I hunted for a poem that had haunted me for years. Why, I had not known. I found it. Francis Thompson's The Hound of Heaven, in an anthology on my bookshelf. I memorized the opening lines. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the midst of tears I hid from him and under running laughter. My psychiatrist had sensed for weeks that the ice jam inside me was beginning to break up. Early on in my treatment, he had remarked that I was telling the story of my life to him in perfectly edited paragraphs. He had been intimating that what I had been leaving out of it was the only thing that mattered, my feelings. When it was late enough to reach him that extraordinary morning, I telephoned and blurted out what was happening to me. "Now," said the doctor, "we can begin." What he said comforted me at the time, but a tiny alarm bell in my mind went ting. Months later, I remembered. He was paraphrasing the shrink's last line in Portnoy's complaint. Soon thereafter, on the way to Washington, D.C., I stopped for a weekend at the house of two friends. For years, their love and support had sustained me in the best and the worst of times. One afternoon, they left me alone in the house while they did some errands. A neighbor's son came to the door. Some guests had dropped in unexpectedly on his parents, and they wondered if they could borrow a bottle of white wine from my friend's exceptionally good stock. I remembered I had seen a bottle in the refrigerator. I gave it to the boy and replenished it with another kind of white wine from their cellar so that they would have some already chilled to sip at dinner. I forgot to tell them that evening about the visit. The next morning, my hostess appeared in my bedroom with breakfast coffee. Something was obviously troubling her, and she was struggling to get it out. Finally, I understood that she was suggesting that I take an earlier train to Washington. Then she said, "I wouldn't have minded except for the wine. I think it would be best if you left." I stared at her. It was the wine, I thought. They thought I stole the wine and drank it. My heart constricted. I explained what had happened, and we laughed about the misunderstanding. But I was overwhelmed with such pain and anger that I felt physically ill. I packed and fled that house within the hour. In Washington, later that day, another close friend, Patricia Herman, welcomed me at her front door. She took one look at my wretched face and said, "My God, what's wrong?" I told her. "Of course you're shattered," Patty said. "They didn't trust you. You haven't had a drink for 8 months, but people still don't trust you." If it had not been for Patty, I might have drunk again. Gradually, I came to realize that I could not resent or dispel the suspicions of even my most unjudging friends by the simple announcement that I had stopped drinking. For years, they had watched me drinking and getting drunk and denying what alcohol was doing to me. It was a year or two after I left Smithers before everyone close to me outside AA was convinced I was serious, that the glass of bubbling liquid I was drinking with them in increasing comfort was plain tonic or club soda. My last and most terrible compulsion to drink gripped me in September 1976. My newspaper sent me to a far corner of northern Maine for an interview with a family of authors. Helen and Jose Iglesias, their son Rafael, and Lewis Cole, Helen's son by a previous marriage, were all writing books in various corners of an old farmhouse. The interview proceeded smoothly with this lively, articulate, and amusing family. I stayed for lunch, and Helen brought out the white wine to accompany it. Without warning, I began to come apart. I wanted to drink that wine with a kind of sickening urgency only an addict knows. My concentration was going. I could not sustain the conversation. I abruptly terminated the interview. I drove like a madwoman, heading for the Bangor airport, an hour and a half away, where I had reserved a room at the airport hotel for the night. By this time, the obsession to drink had seized me, and I was shaking like some great dog. I could barely see the road. Every bar along the way seemed to be beckoning to me. I wanted to drink, but I could not drink. I had been taking a little white antabuse pill every morning for several months, prescribed by a doctor who worked with alcoholics. With antabuse in me, 1 ounce of liquor or less would make me dangerously ill. I pulled up at the Bangor airport, sweating with fear. I telephoned my AA sponsor, Anna L., in New York. She was not there. I called another close AA friend in New York. Jerry said instantly, "Don't stay there overnight. Take the next plane here." He told me to come straight from LaGuardia to his apartment and to stay and talk with him until I felt better. "Stay overnight with me and my wife if you need to," Jerry said. "We'd love to have you." Jerry's calm assurance, the unhesitating willingness to help that is typical in AA, catapulted me onto the next plane to New York and through the hours that followed. After an hour or so with Jerry, I went serenely home to bed. I am convinced that without antabuse in me, I would have pulled in at one of the bars on the road to the Bangor airport. In those early months and years of sobriety, I was deeply grateful to the drug because it protected me from even the most overwhelming urge to drink. I had begun taking a daily dose of antabuse several months before the Bangor episode under the supervision of Dr. Ruth Fox. My psychiatrist, a friend of Dr. Fox's, had suggested I join her small therapy group for alcoholics, which met every Wednesday night at her office apartment in Midtown Manhattan. I loved the group, which had a nucleus of about 8 regulars, all in AA. I immediately took to Dr. Fox and her accepting ways. She was utterly unlike my own psychiatrist, a very tall, weedy, and self-satisfied man who patronized me. That doctor had lectured me about how I managed my money. He had suggested that I assuage my grief over Stan's death by picking up men at concerts. I sensed he did not respect women. He made me angry, although I was too intimidated by his intelligence and the air of command he exuded to say so. But he did send me to Dr. Fox. She was then in her early 80s, twisted with arthritis, but never complaining of her pain. She would sit crumpled in a deep chair in her living room, nodding benignly as her circle of tortured patients struggled their way to recovery. She prescribed antabuse for most of us. Antabuse meant that I made one decision a day not to drink instead of dozens. Some people call it a crutch, but I call it a blessed insurance that strengthened my determination to stay sober a day at a time. Is insulin a crutch for a diabetic? Dr. Fox, the world authority on the drug, told me that when you are saturated with antabuse, you know you cannot drink safely after the last dose for the next 4 or 5 days or even longer. If you do drink on antabuse, you become violently ill. She called it a time bomb that will never go off unless you trigger it with alcohol. It was dispensed by prescription in a white 250-milligram tablet the size of an aspirin. The drug makes you sick if you drink on it, Dr. Fox warned, because it blocks a vital enzyme that helps the body to metabolize alcohol. Since 1950, she had treated thousands of alcoholics with a combination of psychotherapy and advice to stick with AA. I came to her therapy group as a supplement to my AA meetings. She warned me to avoid cough medicines, fruit compotes in wine, and desserts such as rum cake containing uncooked alcohol. But she said I need not avoid dishes in which wine or other alcohol had been evaporated through boiling, baking, or simmering. She told me that I should suffer no side effects as long as I stayed off alcohol. Then she told me what would happen if I did drink on antabuse. Shock-like symptoms, including a drop in blood pressure, rapid heartbeat, flushing, vomiting and fainting, and the necessity to be rushed to a hospital for emergency care. She gave me a card to carry in my purse saying I was on antabuse and giving instructions for treatment. I was suitably frightened. She told me that the medicine would really be a comfort and a support to me in my resolve. Eventually, and it may take several years, she said, you will feel strong enough in your sobriety to do without antabuse altogether. At Dr. Fox's, I found Anna L., a clinical psychologist. Anna L. was co-leader of the Doctor's Wednesday Night Therapy Group. She became my sponsor. A sponsor in AA is not someone who recommends you for entrance. It is a big sister or big brother who has longer experience of sobriety and, under the best of circumstances, becomes your closest friend and advisor. Some people call their sponsors every day, if only to say hello. I called and saw mine frequently. We loved each other. The last service I was able to perform for her and her husband several years later was to write her obituary after her death from cancer. Anna was a tall, bony, aristocratic southerner who wore chic, expensive clothes and was witty and well-educated. No human failing seemed to surprise or disgust her. She was an original and a maverick. She was an atheist, and yet the most spiritual person I have ever known. She stood silent while others recited the Lord's Prayer at the close of AA meetings we attended together. When the choice was the Serenity Prayer, she would not begin it by saying, "God grant us," but "grant us." She did not like rules or formulas. She told me that the 12 steps boil down to 3 suggestions. Be honest, change yourself, help others. I learned from her that being in AA went far beyond staying sober, and that if you stuck with it, you might learn how to cope with life without losing your balance, common sense, or humor. Anna did not lecture. She showed me the way by what she did and was. She represented in her own life and actions the essence of what makes AA work. Several months after I joined Dr. Fox's group, a new man arrived who was clearly in terrible trouble. Rotund and prosperous-looking, dressed in a pinstriped suit, he introduced himself as Frank, a lawyer. He was a graduate of Ivy League schools. As he told his story, perspiration dribbled down his deeply flushed face. He wrung his hands. He jittered. He told us his colleagues knew about his drinking and that they had warned him he would lose his job if he didn't stop. When he had finished his tale of inexorably progressing degradation, he began to pound his knee, slowly and rhythmically. And then in a voice cracking with desperation, he cried out, "I want a drink. I want a drink. I want a drink." A thrill of horror went through me. The other members of the group seemed as stunned as I was. Anna was not present that night, and Dr. Fox simply looked on, waiting for one of us to make a move. I blurted out, "Frank, can I take you to a meeting with me tonight?" He glared around him, radiating danger and intense need. Finally, he said, "Yes." Outside on the corner, waiting for a taxi, Frank said tensely, "I'm not a lawyer. I'm a judge. I'll be ruined if I don't stop drinking." He told me his real name, and I recognized it immediately. I was truly frightened now. But I dragged him off to a meeting up Park Avenue and sat beside him while he sweated and fussed through most of it. I found the speaker exceptionally honest and eloquent, but I knew there was only one thought in Frank's mind, getting the next drink. And so, as we stood outside afterward, I asked him to walk me the short distance home. Frank, a suburbanite, was staying in town that night at his club. The club has a bar. Once I got him inside my apartment, I plied him with plain tonic and talked tough to him. Among other things, I told him that he was lying about taking the antabuse Dr. Fox had given him because I could smell liquor on his breath. I told him parts of my own story. I tried, I must confess, to impress him with my own background and to find every kind of intellectual and social connection with him that I could so that he would not feel that alcoholism was somehow a moral lapse in a man of his quality. I told him about Smithers. By then he was incapable of concentrating and I was running out of steam. He rushed from the apartment, straight for his next drink. I called Dr. Fox, knowing that I had gone against AA's very strong suggestions that 12-steppers, the AA members who try to save active drinkers in crisis, should be of the same sex as the drinker. Dr. Fox assured me that I had done everything I should. A week later, Frank was in Smithers. I visited him after 3 days and could hardly believe the improvement in his appearance and manner. That was 11 years ago. From time to time, Frank and I, two friends with a special bond, have dinner at his club. After 2 years in Dr. Fox's group, despite its special attractions of intimacy and intensity, I began to feel that AA meetings alone would suffice. So I said goodbye to the doctor and to the patients whom I had come to know so well. The diversity of AA meetings astonished me. At home or on the road, I know I will not be a stranger in any room where there are alcoholics to greet me. Once, while visiting London, I was going through a severe emotional crisis and felt the need for a meeting every day. I got the London meeting schedule from AA headquarters and ranged across the city from the West End to Notting Hill Gate and the Tower. There was a noon meeting one weekday in a Catholic church near Covent Garden. I arrived while a mass was going on. The dark, ancient building was packed with worshippers. I peered around in vain for some clue that AA was also in that place. I crept up to an aged beadle standing in the rear. "Where's the AA meeting?" I whispered. In a hoarse croak, audible, I was sure, throughout half the church, the beadle said, "The AA meeting? It's right through that back door there," as he hitched himself around and pointed. I slunk through an old oaken door and found myself mounting a narrow, spiral stone staircase, twisting up and up into darkness. After a moment, I heard footsteps echoing behind me. My heart began to pound. I kept going upward. I quickened my pace. The footfalls followed. Finally, I could bear it no longer. I stopped and turned. A thin, dark man came around the curve, and I thought, "Oh, God, I'm trapped." He said, "Are you going to the meeting?" Feeling humbled and relieved, I nodded and went ahead. I pushed open a door at the top, and there was a little whitewashed room with a thick rope dangling down through a hole in the boarded ceiling. This was the belfry. There was no one in it. There were some folding chairs, an electric heating ring with a kettle on it, thick white china cups, a box of tea, a sink, and several framed AA slogans hanging on the walls. The man and I sat facing each other and waited. Then I said, "Well, as long as there are two of us alcoholics gathered together, I guess we have a meeting. Do you want to go first?" The man smiled and began, "My name is John, and I am an alcoholic." We told our stories to each other, alone there in the belfry high above London. We talked for an hour and parted on the street below. Once, in Nairobi, Kenya, I noticed an advertisement for AA in the local newspaper, announcing that there were 3 English-language meetings and 2 in Swahili every week. That evening, a taxi deposited me in a dusty alley behind a theater on the outskirts of the city. I went into a nondescript brick building. There was not a sign anywhere to tell me what the building was or whether AA was inside it. Then I saw a young woman lugging a big coffee urn, a universal tip-off to the presence of a group of alcoholics up the stairs. "Is this the way to the AA meeting?" I said. She grinned and greeted me, and I fell into step behind her. Of course, the settings were seldom so exotic. The hard work of my recovery was done in hundreds of church basements, many of them drab and some of them forbidding, most of them in my home city of New York. But wherever I went across this country, on business or pleasure, I looked up the Alcoholics Anonymous listing in the local telephone book and called to say, "My name is Nan, I'm from New York, is there a meeting tonight?" The voice on the line was invariably helpful and always asked, "Can we give you transportation?" As I got better, many problems I had pushed down or pushed away by drinking began to surface. The therapy I had begun with Dr. Plum's psychiatrist friend in New York only shortly before joining AA was forcing me to examine my most negative and deeply repressed memories for the first time. Sober, I could not run away from the grief I had felt ever since Stan's death. Sober, I had come face to face with my anger, confusion, and depression. "Of course you're angry," my psychiatrist said. "You are angry because Stan went and died on you and left you a widow at the age of 44. "How could you?" I protested. "It wasn't Stan's fault." "This has nothing to do with reason," the psychiatrist answered. "Everybody's angry. We're all like a bunch of tea kettles simmering and bubbling away with only the rattling of the lids to tell us something is going on underneath." The idea had never occurred to me. In my family, spectacular displays of anger were not only rare but considered unseemly. Anger itself was unseemly. Then the psychiatrist told me of the classic psychoanalytical maxim, "Depression is anger turned inward." I have never heard a better description. My black moods persisted into 1977. I was struggling to get better. There were good days, but then a kind of hopelessness, a bottomless sadness would sweep over me. During our many telephone conversations, my mother would ask me, "Nan, why are you so depressed? You're successful, you have friends, you're not drinking anymore." I would attempt to make light of my condition. "Oh, Mother," I'd say, "there isn't any logic about why people feel depressed. I just am. I can't seem to shake it off." At times, I contemplated suicide. I knew how I would do it. I got up some mornings at dawn to sit on the window ledge of my bedroom. I would gaze long moments, fascinated, unable to tear myself away at the courtyard 10 floors below. I would open the window and lean out and say to myself, "It's 10 stories down, it's quick, and it's certain." A flash of pain and darkness. Then I would shrink back, moving away from the window, hating myself. I could not leave those I loved with a legacy of guilt, asking themselves questions they would never be able to answer. In the spring of 1977, I found myself becoming increasingly confused and frightened. It was a horrible ordeal to go to the office and even more agonizing to try to write. I felt as if I were breaking in pieces. On my days off, I would lie in bed, the curtains drawn, never answering the telephone. Finally, I could not function at all. I called my psychiatrist. I want to go to a hospital, I said. Do you think you might do harm to yourself or others, he asked. I said yes. I committed myself to the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic of New York Hospital that night. When the nurse brought me off the elevator on the 7th floor and locked the door behind me, and I saw the disoriented patients roaming the hall, I was terrified. I'd made a ghastly mistake. I was trapped. I'd signed away my freedom. I rushed to the payphone for patients. Get me out of here, I told my psychiatrist. I don't belong here. The doctor laughed scornfully. Oh, baby, he said, yes, you do. I frantically dialed my internist and friend of more than 20 years, Dr. Ira Cohen. Ira, for God's sake, get me out of here, I said, sobbing. I don't belong here. Nan, dear, said Ira, this is the sanest act of your life. You could have thrown yourself out of the window. You could have taken a drink. Instead, you asked to be put in a safe place. I'm proud of you. I told myself that is the way a doctor should talk to someone in trouble. Within a day or two, I calmed down and began to realize that I really did belong in a mental hospital. The diagnosis was acute depression. I remained for 5 weeks until I was discharged with the doctor's approval. After about 4 weeks there, the Payne Whitney staff had begun to indicate in their conversations, subtly but persistently, that my own psychiatrist was wrong for me. They suggested I try another whom everyone seemed to admire. With her help in the years that followed, I began to heal. My work went better. I fell in love for the first time since Dan's death. And then I was struck with a nearly fatal attack of toxic shock syndrome. It hit me on Thanksgiving night, 1981, while I was visiting my family in Rockford, Illinois. That grisly and still mysterious disease is caused by a deadly strain of common bacterium and is found most commonly in menstruating women who are wearing tampons. Almost every major organ of my body, including my heart, lungs, and liver, was deeply poisoned. The doctors at St. Anthony Hospital in Rockford told me there had also been almost inconceivable muscle damage. By measuring an enzyme that the disease had released into my bloodstream, they could measure that destruction. Anything over 100 units is considered abnormally high. I showed 21,000 units. At first, the doctors thought they would have to amputate my right leg and the toes of my left foot. Because the treatment had been swift and correct, my leg and toes were saved. But the dry gangrene on my fingers persisted, caused by the collapse of my circulatory system on Thanksgiving night. Before I slipped into a coma at dawn the next day, I had been awake and aware enough to tell the emergency room doctors that I was a recovered alcoholic in AA for years. That warned them not to give me addictive drugs or medicine with alcohol as a base. I had been told at Smithers to do that with every new physician. The information went into my hospital record. When the critical phase was over, I had 8 partially dead and gangrenous fingers, a form of paralysis in both feet that could have left me with a permanent limp and severely poisoned damaged muscles all over my body. A close friend from New York came to see me. Your hands were a mummy's hands, she told me long afterwards. The fingers were black and shriveled with small, perfect black nails. I almost fainted when I saw them. It was clear by then that the end joints of all 8 fingers would have to be amputated. The day the surgeon told me he would have to operate, I was filled with horror. I was certain I would never be able to write again. I was certain that nobody would ever love me again. After 10 dark, troubled years, I had finally emerged the previous summer into what Winston Churchill had called the broad, sunlit uplands of life. Now fate had once again struck me down. As soon as they took me off the respirator and I could speak again, I began to heap my anger onto my family, the doctors and nurses. I reviled everyone who entered the room. I became imperious, demanding, argumentative, impossible. One day, when my sister materialized at the foot of the bed, I looked at her with hatred. Go home, I said icily. For at least 10 days, I was possessed by fury at everyone. Then, one afternoon, 2 strange women appeared in the doorway of my room. I turned to the nurse, saying, "Who are these people?" There was a little silence, and then one of the women said, very gently, "We are friends of Bill Wilson." I welcomed them in. Afterward, who is an alcoholic? Are you worried about your drinking? If you are, chances are you have reason and do have a drinking problem. But you're not weak-willed, you are not mentally unbalanced, you are not a bad person. You may be ill with the disease of alcoholism. Try to answer yes or no to the following 26 questions. Your responses are nobody's business but your own. Be honest with yourself, with the decent person you know yourself to be. The questions, drawn from more than 40 years of experience, were put together by the National Council on Alcoholism, the first nationwide volunteer agency in the field of this disease. They should help you decide whether you need help. Remember, answer yes or no to each. 1. Do you occasionally drink heavily after a disappointment, a quarrel, or when the boss has given you a hard time? 2. When you have trouble or feel under pressure, do you always drink more heavily than usual? 3. Have you noticed that you are able to handle more liquor than you did when you were first drinking? 4. Did you ever wake up on the morning after and discover that you could not remember part of the evening before, even though your friends tell you that you did not pass out? 5. When drinking with other people, do you try to have a few extra drinks when others will not know it? 6. Are there certain occasions when you feel uncomfortable if alcohol is not available? 7. Have you recently noticed that when you begin drinking, you are in more of a hurry to get the first drink than you used to be? 8. Do you sometimes feel a little guilty about your drinking? 9. Are you secretly irritated when your family or friends discuss your drinking? 10. Have you recently noticed an increase in the frequency of your memory blackouts? 11. Do you often find that you wish to continue drinking after your friends say they have had enough? 12. Do you usually have a reason for the occasions when you drink heavily? 13. When you are sober, do you often regret things you have done or said while drinking? 14. Have you tried switching brands or following different plans for controlling your drinking? 15. Have you often failed to keep the promises you have made to yourself about controlling or cutting down on your drinking? 16. Have you ever tried to control your drinking by making a change of jobs or moving to a new location? 17. Do you try to avoid family or close friends while you are drinking? 18. Are you having an increasing number of financial and work problems? 19. Do more people seem to be treating you unfairly without good reason? 20. Do you eat very little or irregularly when you are drinking? 21. Do you sometimes have the shakes in the morning and find that it helps to have a little drink? 22. Have you recently noticed that you cannot drink as much as you once did? 23. Do you sometimes stay drunk for several days at a time? 24. Do you sometimes feel very depressed and wonder whether life is worth living? 25. Sometimes, after periods of drinking, do you see or hear things that aren't there? 26. Do you get terribly frightened after you have been drinking heavily? The National Council on Alcoholism says, if you answered yes to any of the questions, you have some symptoms that may indicate alcoholism. The American Medical Association provides a checklist for doctors summing up when a patient should be suspected as an alcoholic. The list of 13 points grows ever more serious as it reflects the progression of the disease and the increasing disruption of the alcoholic's life. 1. Increasing consumption of alcohol, whether on a regular or sporadic basis, with frequent and perhaps unintended episodes of intoxication. 2. Drinking as a means of handling problems or relieving symptoms. 3. Obvious preoccupation with alcohol and the expressed need to have a drink, especially if habitually repeated. 4. Surreptitious drinking or gulping of drinks. 5. Tendency toward making alibis and weak excuses for drinking. 6. Refusal to concede what is obviously excessive consumption and expressing annoyance when the subject is mentioned. 7. Frequent absenteeism from the job, especially if occurring in a pattern, such as following weekends and holidays, Monday morning flu. 8. Repeated changes in jobs, particularly if to successively lower levels, or employment in a capacity beneath ability, education, and background. 9. Shabby appearance, poor hygiene, and behavior and social adjustment inconsistent with previous levels or expectations. 10. Persistent vague somatic complaints without apparent cause, particularly those of insomnia, gastrointestinal difficulties, headaches, anorexia. 11. multiple contacts with the healthcare system with disorders that are alcohol-caused or related. 12, persistent marital and family problems, perhaps with multiple marriages. 13, history of arrests for drunkenness or drunken driving. What can people who think they may be alcoholic do for themselves? They can talk to somebody, break out of that prison of loneliness and fear and shame. They are lucky that their disease happens to be alcoholism because there is so much help out there. They are lucky also that it can be arrested at once by stopping drinking. Pick up the phone and call AA. It is listed in the telephone directory of every city and town in America. The man or woman on the other end of the phone, a recovered alcoholic, will listen carefully and then reach another recovered alcoholic who can talk to you within minutes or hours by phone or this very day in person. If you are not comfortable with the thought of going directly to AA, talk with a trusted member of the clergy, with your doctor or psychotherapist, with a social worker, with a friend you feel will not judge you but is likely to be honest with you, with your husband, wife, or lover. The point is, you must talk about it. Your burden is too great to be borne alone. Talk to someone without a drink in you. If you're high or drunk, it'll be the bottle talking, not you, and you will not clearly absorb what someone else is saying. If you are in therapy, your aim should not be to discover why you drink. You drink, and you have used alcohol to blunt and cover up your problems, to run away from them, to anesthetize yourself. First, you get sober. Then you confront your problems with a clear mind. Friends and family can help, but in the end, the decision to stop drinking is up to the alcoholic. Of course you're afraid. You're afraid that you cannot live without alcohol. You're afraid that you will never have fun anymore, never enjoy a party, never be comfortable with yourself or with others who can drink socially. You're afraid you will be thought different if you take drinks that do not have booze in them. None of this is true for long. Remember that other people are interested only in what they have in their own glass. Are you afraid that your friends may pity you or laugh at you or urge you to have just one drink? In that case, they are not your friends. These are cruel and hostile reactions to a recovering alcoholic. Also, the chances are good that such friends have a drinking problem themselves. Are you afraid that you are weak, ashamed that your willpower is not strong enough for you to stop drinking by yourself? Try feeling the reverse. Try being ashamed that you are not seeking help for your illness. Are you afraid that you are insane? Many alcoholics have secretly feared that they are mentally disturbed. They can go for years masking their growing fears by drinking even more. Remember that alcohol affects the central nervous system. It distorts personality, perception, intelligence, common sense. No wonder you think you may be crazy. Certainly, your brain is impaired by drinking, and that means everybody, no matter how well you think you hold your liquor. Have you told yourself, okay, it's a disease, I can't help myself, so I'll keep on drinking? Or are you asking yourself, am I sick and tired of being sick and tired? If you are an alcoholic, or suspect you may be one, turn to another human being. You cannot hope to solve your problem alone. The sooner you seek help, the better for you and for those you love. There are people out there who want to help you. All it takes is one step, one telephone call, one conversation to begin the process of healing. You need never be alone again. You will be free.